Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, our favorite show is Orange is the New Black, Season 5, released June 9th on Ye Olde Netflix. And I am your host, the Mandated Reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattledge. And theoretically, joining me tonight will be Sean Comer. We are going to wait for him to call in. In the meantime, let's get this party started. Orange is the New Black Season 5. It has been renewed for a few more seasons past this. It picks up at the cliffhanger ending from Season 4. If you, by now, if you're listening to this podcast, I'm sure you've watched Season 4. You know what happened. The short synopsis of Season 4 is basically... The previous guards had all quit due to unfair wages and unfair practices stemming from the corporate entity that had been controlling the prison at MCC. So they all quit, and with a shortage of guards, Caputo, you know, demands that MCC send them some guards, which they do. They also start a program, I believe, for returning vets, where they can live on the property in cabins and be guards in the prison. And the guards run anywhere from abusive to just negligent. One of them in particular really loses it at the end and decides he's going to sneak a gun into the prison, a particularly disreputable guard. And, of course, after Poussey's death by C.O. Bailey and the subsequent mishandling, if you will, of the death by Caputo, who was the warden, there is anger brewing, you know, especially being led by Poussey, by rather Tasty, Black Cindy, Janae, Allison, et cetera. There's just anger that had been simmering all season due to mistreatment by some of these guards, especially the lead guard, Piscatella, just erupts. And, of course, this then smashes directly into the idiot guard who brought the gun into the prison, which he then loses, and it is picked up by Daya. And the season ends with Daya pointing said gun directly at this guard. That is where we begin Season 5. A couple of things right off the bat. Season 5 takes place over the course of a few days. So rather than, you know, a year passing by, and now remember, we are on riding on the shoulders of our lead, and while the show itself has broadened into more of a an ensemble piece, it is through the eyes of Piper Chapman, played by Taylor Schilling, I believe, that, you know, we get a view into the federal prison, the women's federal prison, if you will. And her sentence, I believe, is only 18 months. So they've taken over the course of four seasons, now five seasons, they've taken great care to make sure they time doesn't pass too fast, as we will then run out of time spent with this character. And, you know, she's the lead, so what are you going to do? I know in previous seasons, and both Sean and I have said this, Piper is not our favorite character. If it wasn't for most of the other cast, we might not still be watching this show. But I have to say, this is probably the first season where I found her to be sympathetic the whole time. This is one of the only seasons I've seen her in where she didn't drive me up the wall. So, you know, good on the writers for not making her terrible this season. But looking at some of the themes of season five, you know, this one really deals with justice in the prison system. It is through the prism of Poussey's death previously by C.O. Bailey, which was accidental. There was a bit where he's holding her down and Suzanne jumps on Bailey and he's trying to deal with Suzanne, but he has his knee on Poussey's back. And Poussey is a small woman and she ends up basically being choked to death, flattened, if you will. It was accidental, but it was, you know, she was killed. Avoidable. The whole situation at that point was avoidable. Bailey was sort of the archetype of the poorly trained guard, you know, whose heart may have been in the right place and wanted to do a good job and was not neglectful, benignly neglectful or vicious as some of the other guards are. But he's the one that, you know, that in his ineptitude made a mistake. So there is time spent this season with him and results of that encounter. A lot of the season deals with the fallout of Poussey's death and how it affected some of our main characters, especially Tasty, who comes to play a significant role in this season. But as I said before, the season revolves around justice. Another theme of this is power. You know, the old saying, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. We've spent the previous season of terrible guards doing terrible things to these women, and now the power dynamic has changed. How does that change some of these women? Some of them will become abusive themselves, some of them will become neglectful, and some of them will not give in to base desires and, you know, and will retain their humanity. Towards the end of the season, the retention of one's humanity plays a pivotal role in a decision regarding Red and Piscatella, but we'll get there before the end of this hour. So picking up where season four left off, the women have pretty much stormed the hallways. They are surrounding the guard, and the guard's name, if I remember correctly, is Humphrey, C.O. Humphrey. He is on his knees, if you please. He is on his knees, and the question becomes, will Daya shoot him? Now, Daya in season four was trying to find her own identity separate from her mother. She was trying to find her way. Her mother had been in it, and even in a flashback in this episode, in this season, it is shown that Aleda had a significant influence over Daya's decision-making. And Daya keeps coming to this place of, I need to have my own identity. And so towards the end of season four, she started to buck the system a little bit. She started to feel her oats. And of course, now she's got the gun. And she's got it trained on him, and you've got women saying, shoot him, and, you know, there's just a lot of chaos. And when Humphrey starts to beg for his life in Spanish, which, as we all know, Daya doesn't know Spanish, she shoots him in the thigh. Meanwhile, our titular leads, Piper and Voss, are trying to avoid the fray. They, you know, Piper's only got like 3 months left on her sentence. And, you know, Voss has already had her fill of trouble. They don't want to be involved in any of this. They certainly don't want to feel the comeuppance when that finally comes. So they are exit stage left. They run into Linda, who is the purchasing manager for MCC. And Linda, initially they take her hostage in a way, you know, of sorts. But eventually they sort of take pity on her, and she dresses up as one of the inmates, and she starts to fashion a story for herself, and she basically blends in while the chaos ensues. As I said, Humphreys is shot in the leg. Really, the rest of the episode is setting the stage for the rest of the season. In general, the women take the place over. Tasty and her group of women take over Caputo's office. It's Caputo and the PR rep in the office. The rest of the prisoners gather up the COs, overpower them, and they are taken hostage. There are two male COs that initially gain an upper hand and sort of take over the kitchen, but in episode 2, I believe it is, which focuses on Frida, Frida gets out of the little prison they fashioned for her and three of the white supremacist girls, and they are overtaken and put in with the rest of the hostages. So that's the setup for the season. Eventually, Caputo and the PR rep are bunched together with the rest of the hostages, and where we move from here, there are a couple of different storylines. We've got Leanne and Angie, who are trying to get high and run amok, and they are the examples of not necessarily in total it is in fact a corruption of power. They are, you know, they're essentially given the power of freedom, and with that freedom, with that power, comes total abuse. They are running around pantsing people. They, at some point, they will target Pennsylvania and make her life miserable. At one point, Leanne will have the gun, and they will initiate a semi-abusive talent show performed by the guards that are hostages, things like that. We have a storyline with Red and Blanca, who end up getting high on amphetamines that are in one of the office desks, which they think are vitamins. And so Blanca and Red spend much of the season running around high together. Their intention is to look for evidence of corruption among the guards, and they find it in Piscatella. Murdered an inmate back at his previous prison, which is why he got transferred, which is told through flashback later on. One of the main bits of story here, one of the main plot elements, is the seeking of justice, specifically by Poussey and company. Poussey, as I said, has been killed, and Tasty is mad as hell over the handling of the situation, and she's sort of single-mindedly focused on getting justice for Poussey. I have to say that is the strongest part of the season, and ultimately the most tragic. Is Tasty's quest for justice on behalf of Poussey, because it sprawls into essentially a list of demands, and these demands are not out of order. These demands are for basic rights for people in a correctional institution. They want the GED program back, want better food, they want better health care. They want appropriate staffing in terms of guards and in terms of medical professionals. So you have all of that. And, you know, there's, of course, they want hot Cheetos because, you know, hot Cheetos. Hot Cheetos for breakfast. They also, and this is more tasty than anybody else, they want C.O. Bailey arrested, tried, and essentially hung, though that not stated directly. I think they settled for prison, but still, a hanging would have sufficed. The part of season five, and let me say this, season five overall is a mixed bag. I didn't love it. I have loved Orange is the New Black in previous seasons. I did not love season five. I didn't hate season five. There were parts of it I liked that I thought were strong, and there were elements of it that were unwatchable that I had to fast forward through some of this stuff. Couple of examples of things I had to fast forward through that were just fucking unwatchable. The Litchfield's Got Talent, the actual talent show, and subsequently before that, when Maria had all of the CEOs on a stage and was doing strip searches and was essentially humiliating and abusing them, both of those things were unwatchable to me. Aleda at some point gets chosen by a local news team to come on and speak on behalf of the prisoners, and it goes poorly, and it's so dumb, and it's so bad that that was also unwatchable. And lastly, and then we're going to take a pause for the cause here, a lot of the flashbacks, which were so important to understanding the characters and then sometimes informing the themes and plots of previous episodes, a lot of them had a lot to do with what I was watching and were boring. And not that they were unwatchable, like the Litchfield's Got Talent thing, but more I just felt like, okay, I don't know why this is important to me and why I need to know any of this. Like Frida's backstory and Linda's backstory I thought were interesting. But, you know, just as an example, Piper getting a tattoo with Larry, I couldn't give a shit about. And while I guess it informs the later decision for her and Voss to get, you know, for her to propose to Voss and get married and, you know, declare their importance to one another, you could have done all that even without the stupid flashback. So, yeah, that was one I just fast-forwarded through. All right, as I said, we're taking a pause for the cause here to bring on my co-host. Everybody, welcome to Litchfield. Mr. Sean Comer, how do you do, sir?
Hi, everybody. I'm Sean. You're not, and I am not a smart man.
Thanks, Forrest.
All right. I fucking hate time zones. You told me 8:30, and for some reason in my brain, the only way it clicked was 8:30 Central Time. So I'm sitting upstairs having a cup of coffee and chatting with my stepdad, and I come down, I look at my phone, and I've got a message that says, "You ready to go?" I said, "Yeah," basically thinking you're just kicking in about 40 minutes before showtime. Said, "I already started." Oh, fuck. Fuck me.
All right. I don't want to go all the way back through my intro here. I've set up this is a continuation of what happened in season four.
Sure.
What I was talking about when I brought you in here was, I'm going to throw it right to you after this. I felt the season was a mixed bag. There were a lot of the strength of the show resides in the theme of justice and the pursuit of justice by Tasty and company. Second to that, the flipping of the power dynamic and the idea of power corrupting and absolute power corrupting absolutely. So you have, you know, some of the prisoners, some of the inmates just losing their sense of humanity, others retaining it and others becoming completely corrupted by the whole process. Those were the two strongest elements of it and definitely things I want to talk about. The weakest stuff I thought was a lot of the flashbacks, and there were some real uncomfortable, for me at least, there were a lot of uncomfortable scenes that I had to fast forward through. I named a couple of them already, but The Talon Show, Aleda on the News.
Oh, yeah.
The humiliation of the guards in the chapel. A couple of other things here or there, but it was borderline. I don't know if pornographic's the right word, but it was just unwatchable to me. I don't want to see people suffer that unnecessarily, I guess.
So
like I said, the season was a mixed bag. What say you?
You know, to be perfectly honest with you, I was really a lot more focused on the first half of the season. And so if those are the episodes that I keep coming back to sort of make my point, think of this as my way of saying, as the kids say, sorry, not sorry. I can't apologize for the fact that by the time I got midway through, quite frankly, I was getting a bit exhausted, I found. And that's rare for me with this show. I was intrigued coming into the season because I liked the idea of having everything take place over the course of this standoff over the span of just a couple of days. Because I thought for a while that the show badly needed some freshening up, especially if they wanted to really address the Saved by the Bell conundrum that they kind of have going on, where this show is supposed to take place over what is a relatively short amount of time. And they're now running into 5 seasons, and you kind of feel with each season that you're watching going, aren't we coming up on about the time when Chapman is supposed to be released?
Right.
At which point, theoretically, isn't that supposed to be the end of the series? But this was a good idea, and mixed bag is a good description. It's a great description, in fact, because there were a lot of things that I liked. I was really intrigued by the way that they split the major factions and gave them all each their own arc, their own dynamic, and really kind of, for the most part, kept the interaction mostly within them. You have the blacks who are much more focused on getting some justice for Poussey. They want to improve the overall conditions of Litchfield, but eventually they really draw that down onto wanting to make sure that the books are balanced for what happened to their friend, to their compatriot. The Latinas are the ones who seem to be the most focused on wanting to really seize upon the power vacuum that has been created by this coup and kind of take over and reshape Litchfield for their own means for the most part. I mean, obviously trying to look out for themselves and to a lesser extent to everybody else, but they're being much less proactive and progressive and forward-thinking than the blacks are. And then you've got the whites who are just splintered in myriad directions. You've got Piper and Voss who are kind of heading up this camp that's just out in the yard for everybody who just wants to maintain a minimum safe distance from this shit show. You've got Doggett and Big Boo who are sort of trying to carve out their own little personally advantageous niche on the inside. You've got, you know, for several episodes, you've got the saga of how Judy King is just trying to navigate the whole situation in general. You've got the two white trash druggies. I can never exactly remember their names.
Angie and Leanne.
Who and Leanne?
Angie.
Angie, thank you. You've got Angie and Leanne, who are just kind of making Litchfield their own personal playground and trying to make the best of it. And the result, unfortunately, is that you've got a whiplash of tones that goes back and forth throughout a given episode that really makes it hard to kind of become immersed. The immersion gets really broken constantly by just how much is going on at this point. And it's been going in this direction, I would say, since season two, since they started taking the focus more and more off of Piper and directing it onto everybody else. In fact,
yeah, this became, sorry. Go ahead.
I was gonna say the summation of that is it's getting to the point where you couldn't reasonably submit Taylor Schilling for best lead actress in an Emmy or Golden Globe category anymore because she's just not in that much of any given episode.
No. I had said that beyond set that this has become much more an ensemble piece. This is actually the first season I don't hate Piper. that she fully has my sympathy, you know, as somebody just dealing with a terrible situation and isn't a terrible person herself. The only thing I was going to add to that, Sean, was, you know, you picked up on something that a lot of the reviewers that are aggregated on Rotten Tomatoes picked up on. A lot of the reviews that I read said a similar thing, which is this is drifting away from situational type of, you know, now it's called a dramedy. But to make my point, this started out as more of like a situational comedy in the sense that the situation is you've got, a white American princess in a federal prison. Hilarity ensues. Okay, that got, you know, they beat that to death. And now the show is, like I said, it's just drifting into what do we do about the prison industrial complex and how it affects people, how it affects the prisoners, how it affects their families, how it affects the people who work in the prison industrial complex, what it does to one's humanity and all of these different milieus. So that's not nearly as funny as Red giving Piper a biscuit full of douche, you know? So
you know what? What came to mind, and I've been thinking about this more and more with every season that has kind of passed, this has become, man, you know, she's helmed so few shows, I don't really want to call it a signature, but given that Jenji Cohen was most famous prior to this as being the creator of Weeds, it's a hard comparison not to make. And that is, in both cases, you have a main character on essentially an ensemble show who it becomes harder and harder to like and really root for as time goes on. And not even really in a Walter White anti-hero kind of way, or like a lot of the characters on Sons of Anarchy, but in the sense that you just watch just in total bafflement as the life choices just get worse and worse, and the character apparently learns sweet F.A. from the desperate fixes they find themselves in. I've seen people point to, and it's been so long, I forget which season it is, but the season opener of Weeds, wherein Nancy Botwin has just gotten out of prison, and the very first thing she does is sets up an operation selling hash. But the thing is with this one is, yeah, Piper became hard, if not impossible, to like from about the second season onward, but it's not even a point wherein she's so detestable that everybody else looks better by comparison. It's just that she gets so little screen time and so little to do in the arc of each season after the first that you can't help but be more invested in everybody else to the point where Taylor Schilling could not be in season six at all, and I'm not sure either of us would hardly notice.
No, like I said, I didn't hate her this season. This is the first season where my feelings toward her ranged from I liked her to lukewarm, you know, where I was much more in the character who deserves, there are two characters who I think deserve, I know one of them has already been nominated for a bunch, that deserve Emmys, and were this two probably the strongest performances of the entire season, and one of which, who led the arc that to me was the most interesting, and that's Danielle Brooks as Tasty.
Yeah.
Secondary to that, Uzo Aduba as Suzanne. You know, as somebody who works in the mental health field, looking at somebody who whose personal arc of this season is with the loss of structure and ultimately the loss of her caretakers who make sure that she takes her meds, descends into insanity. And I'll tell you, Uzo Aduba, they need to keep giving her awards. Just keep throwing them at her. Her performance as crazy ass Suzanne this season was phenomenal. But the shitster in me, the punk rock in me, loved Danielle Brooks's Tasty, who really steps out of herself. I mean, she had become sort of the gang mom in the previous seasons among this group of African-American women. And in this one, she steps into a different role. She becomes the advocate. And her interactions with Caputo and Figueroa and the decisions that she makes and ultimately how she just destroys the entire thing with her single-mindedness was phenomenal. And had I, you know, and obviously they couldn't focus the entire season on just that, but if they had, I'd have been satisfied. You know, it wouldn't have been a steak dinner, but it would have been a nice bit of chicken salad.
It would have been a pork chop. But the thing is, my one problem with almost every scene that Tasty is in is unfortunately a character that, and I want to say, I'm in past years when we've done this, I've kind of tried to be a little more out there with my opinions and perhaps a little more outrageous than I needed to be for the sake of entertainment. This time I'm just shooting straight from the hip with this. Black Cindy had become kind of a character that had been redeemed in my eyes, if not so much for her actions and her arc, but for the fact that she had been lent a little bit of depth and had been made slightly more than this show's Jimmy Walker, essentially.
Right.
But now it felt like this season, every time they tried to take it back to a more serious place between the wonderful dialogue given to Tasty and I would also add Janae and again, I'm terrible with names. The one Muslim young lady,
Allison.
Yes. Those three in any scene that kind of took it back to the black faction were absolutely outstanding through and through the entire way. But again, it's that immersion breaking. It's the idea that you can have a perfectly fine, dramatic, well-written, balanced scene with those three, but for some fucking reason, off to the side, every single time, someone has decided that we have to have Cindy off to the side cutting up. And yet at no point does any of the other three get absolutely sick of this and react the way I would think a natural person would at a time like this, and that is to absolutely bitch slap the taste out of her mouth.
Can I take this moment to disagree with you?
What'd you say?
Well, I want to debate that because. And if I cut you off before you were getting to this point that I'm about to make, I apologize. But I do feel like that moment came just not the way you're not the way you're wanting it to. There comes a point, and it deals directly with Suzanne, where Black Cindy goes to Tasty and says, you have to fix this. Suzanne's off her rocker. And she's like, there's bigger problems right now going on in this prison than one crazy-ass Suzanne. You have to deal with this. And then she does, and she fucks it up and goes back to Tasty. And Tasty says, you created the problem. Now you have to fix it. Again, I have bigger fish to fry. And Black Cindy rises to that challenge and realizes that she has to. So the problem with Black Cindy is that as a character, she's written as extremely self-centered and flip. And she has an arc this season in dealing with Suzanne and having some of the gang mom duty shifted to her while Tasty splinters off to become the advocate, where she has to be outside of herself and she has to think of another, that other being Suzanne, and she can't be completely self-centered. And she does rise to that challenge. In a lot of ways, Cindy is a terrible hero. She's just a shitty hero in this season. And so I know we talked before about how terrible a character Black Cindy can be at times, but I do feel like she continued her character transition of being, I wouldn't go as far as saying selfless, but not completely selfish.
Well, yes, but still, totally. It's frustrating when I'll really be into a scene like that, and you know, it's like watching a scene from Fences between Denzel Washington and Viola Davis, who are turning in just absolutely career performance, like the two of them at their very best, and it would be like all of a sudden Rick were to pop up in the foreground with a wubba lubba dub dub right in the middle of dialogue. That's what it's like to have a scene with anybody with all these other performers, and Black Cindy is frustrating. It's aggravating, and it's almost like this season at times it feels like the writers have forgotten where a joke should go and how far to take it. I felt the same way in the first episode of the season when they kept just haphazardly name-dropping headline-making tragic shootings. And I don't know really what purpose it served, because every time they did it, it just became progressively more and more awkward. It didn't feel like something that I would be seeing on an episode of Orange is the New Black. It felt like it should be a throwaway gag from Community or Family Guy or something. That, oh, you go to one scene and blah, 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 Virginia Tech, blah, 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 Sandy Hook, blah, 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 Fort Hood. Forced would be putting it nicely. And there were moments where the humor was actually kind of nice. You mentioned the talent show scene, and I would admit that was, yes, that was horribly, horribly awkward. It still came in second to the scene in the chapel, but it was hard to watch, with the exception of the fact that, in spite of myself, yeah, I laughed my ass off when, again, lousy with names tonight, so I'm just gonna call him C.O. Cesaro. started his TLC inspired striptease. I thought it was hysterical. Which there's another character with some serious range, because the very next episode, God damn, you end up feeling terrible for the guy, both the actor and the character, because they're trying to depict him clearly having a very serious breakdown over these conditions, because he seems to have a genuine hang-up about going to the bathroom in front of people, which I understand is definitely a thing. And yet, with the whole thing where he's walking around the cell and singing selections from The Sound of Music and everybody's yelling at him that they hate him, it's hard to tell if that's being played for laughs or if they're actually trying to depict something dramatically. And I get that it doesn't have to be black or white, but this is that was almost too muddy. You know, that was almost a little bit too much. Whereas, oddly enough, the repeated gag they did where Caputo was taped in the urinal and actually had some fairly wise words to impart to an inmate, and was trying to be a peaceful voice of reason, and they just kind of walk off and pretty much never hear these important things he's trying to say to them. For some reason, yeah, that actually made me chuckle a little bit.
There were
I don't know. Did you sometimes have the same trouble kind of getting a bead on tone that I did?
Let's address this, and then we'll move on to something else. I said before that a lot of the reviewers really struggled with the shift away from the more comedic elements of the show into the more dramatic elements. And I didn't. I don't have a problem with it. Two, I don't think the shticky comedy elements of this beyond the first season were all that entertaining to me. Not that I ever wanted Orange is the New Black to descend into Oz, but because even that got a bit bleak.
A bit,
but I mean, I think, you know, once they've established that prison conditions aren't good, there comes a choice that the show has to make, and that is, it's just going to be just nothing but individual character pieces and, you know, and character arcs, or are we going to address a larger issue? And Sean, I don't want to get preachy. This isn't what the show is about. We're here to discuss a television show, but you can't discuss the show without discussing this part of it, and that is the prison industrial complex and justice in incarceration settings isn't funny.
Well, Mark, by all means, if you have a deeply held opinion about that, one of the things that I like about this show is, you know, we do this every year, and I very genuinely enjoy hearing what you have to say about it, because it's not every day that everyone necessarily gets to hear this side of the story from somebody who has actually kind of been in that kind of proximity to some of the situations that this show is depicting. So by all means, if you want to get preachy, go right ahead. I mean, I'll mute my phone and just sit back and listen with a cup of coffee and enjoy every word, pal.
You don't have to do that. But I will say, I applaud the show for taking these issues head on. And unfortunately, I get where I think where the writers are coming from. It's hard to make a joke of this stuff. It's hard to make a joke of institutions that, first of all, house a lot of people that were mistreated by the justice system in the first place. I mean, John Oliver does a really great job of doing selected pieces on different elements of the justice system. At the end of the season, where Linda tries to tell one of the CERT team people that Linda, in case you figure out who the character is the purchasing exec from MCC who has run around the entire season disguised as an inmate, so as not to be taken hostage. But at the end, she's trying to tell one of the CERT team people, I'm one of you. I work for MCC. I'm not a prisoner. And then, of course, Boo, who has been hurt by this woman emotionally, and then the Nazis, who are just terrible, you know, all start saying, I work for MCC, too. So now she sounds like a crazy person, and she isn't being listened to. My God, if there was ever a summation for what it's like for people in the prison industrial complex, it's that. It's this idea of, I am not being heard. I legitimately have an issue. I legitimately have a problem. And I am ignored and treated as less than, if not crazy. I see it all the time, and there's not a whole lot I can do about it from my position, but individually, one-to-one, from me to these people, I try to listen to everybody, and I try to hear them. And sometimes these people are really are lunatics, you know, who are just, you know, I don't want to get into it, but what they have to say, it really is meaningless. But there are situations where people, they have something to say. They need to be heard. You know, they are being treated unjustly, and someone does need to listen to them. And a situation needs to be dealt with. And 9 out of 10 times, it's not. And they're all Linda, who is a free person who has done nothing wrong conceivably, and is yet still being treated like a prisoner who is not a worthwhile human being. You know, I said to my mother-in-law recently, I said, it's just a situation where my daughter was going to a sleepover, and she's 6, and this is not an invitation to discuss my parenting, but I want to tell this story real quick. You know, I made it a point to talk to Lily about good touch and bad touch, and, you know, sleepovers can be ripe with situations where somebody, you know, gets abused or gets molested. And I said to her, mm-hmm. I said, look, you know, have fun at this thing, enjoy yourself, but do remember, you know, essentially good touch, bad touch. And I said it once to her privately, and I brought it up again the night before the sleepover, and my mother-in-law got all on my case. She was like, why would you talk to her that way, and why would you say that to her, and you're going to put ideas in her head. And I was like, do you know the vast amount of women I talk to on a weekly basis who were all molested as children by people they knew in situations like the one she's going to? So I think I have every right to have that discussion. And the answer I got back is, yes, but you only work with the dregs of society. To round this back to the discussion of this television show, when the majority of the world looks at these people as the dregs of society, like they are not worth justice, they are not worth fairness, they are not worth taking care of, they are not worth humanity, that personally irks me. It's the reason why I continue to do what I do, because at least as one person, one-to-one, individually, I can try to help as many of them as I can as needed. If they hear one decent, humane voice in these places, at least it'll be mine. So, and I'm doing a little bit of something, you know, a 0.0001% of something. And the show is handling those things. The show is addressing them. The show just said what I said this season. These are human beings. And yes, many of them did something wrong, and there must be recompense. But many of them were, I don't want to use the word victims, but I don't know what other word to use, victims of a justice system that preys on, as Ice-T would say, anybody without money. You know, these are the No Lives Matter people. You have to hear the song. It's a great song.
I feel like the show, for the most part, does a fair job of not going overboard with the idea that, you know, trying to make martyrs of sort of every single character and making it
Absolutely.
Out as though nobody we see actually deserves to go to prison. No, there are some for whom they make it very clear that they probably shouldn't be in that environment in the first place, given the circumstances of their crimes. Suzanne comes right to mind, as well as a number of others. We never get it in a flashback exactly, but look at the story we got behind why Jones is incarcerated. She was high one night, thought that a child was a deer, and shot it. I would think that that would usually probably get pled down to a much lesser sentence than what she actually got. But there are some that we see throughout the show wherein by the time their flashback is over, we kind of go, ah, no, maybe you don't deserve the treatment that you're getting now, but you certainly deserve to be roughly where you are, and that is, incarcerated.
I
Flocka,
100%
do you
agree
think?
with you. 100% agree with you, but the question then becomes, what should a prison be? I'm going to make this one point and then I'm going to let this go. But there are plenty of prisons throughout Europe that are 100% rehabilitative. They are, people get educations and I think I've seen pictures of some prisons in like Switzerland or Sweden or something where like they look like college dorms. So does a prison, does a prison have to be a quote unquote prison, or is it a correctional institution? And that I think is the heart of at least part of this season, is this desire, and certainly something that's important to me, to see prisons become correctional institutions and not gulags.
So
And I
in
guess
other words, so in other words, a facility where things like the GED programs and access to legal aid remains fully intact and aren't the first things that get cut when the belt has to be tightened.
Frida talks about they had a swimming program that was cut shortly before, I think it's Figueroa who comes on board. I can't remember what exactly is the event that coincides with the swimming program being cut. But idle hands are the devil's playthings. And when you give people that sense of community, and they've done this in previous seasons. One season they had the garden, and yes, the garden was abused in some ways, but ultimately
Yeah,
the garden gave some of.
in the first season, there was that episode where they were ready to close the track.
Right. Things like that. When you take away everything from people that gives them a reason to get up in the morning. You leave them with nothing but their thoughts, and in a place like a prison, their thoughts can become quite negative. What we were talking about here, and then let's transition into some other elements of the show. We can keep the conversation moving. I guess the struggle is, how do you make any of what I have just said for the past 10 minutes funny? It's hard to. It is important stuff, and you don't want to necessarily be preachy. And you don't want to, and the object of the show is to still be entertaining, but there's a story to tell and an issue to address, and it can't be all things, becomes drama. And when there's more of that than there is comedy, I think people who want it to be more comedy than drama start to lose interest or become uncomfortable or both. For me, it made the show, and this is just my personal opinion, for me, it made the show more interesting. I'm more interested as they delve deeper into the issues of the prison industrial complex than I was with seeing some wasp struggle with shitty prison life. But that's just me. Before you came on, I was just starting to address some of the things I didn't like about this season. I'll just quick bullet point these, and then I want to throw it to you to talk for you to discuss them. Like I said, there were a lot of awkward, unwatchable moments. The flashbacks I didn't think worked well beyond a handful, like Frida and Linda's story. Leanne and Angie's arc of being abusive bullies got old after two or three episodes. They're just not that interesting characters.
You lasted that long before it got old?
If I think of something else, I'll throw it in there. But ultimately, but those are my issues with this season. Those are the things that made me not love it. What were the elements of this season you didn't love?
They were about the same. They were about the same as yours. I mean, mostly it was the fact that even though everything was taking place within the same fishbowl of tumult, like I said, it felt so unfocused. A lot of times, like, there was no thematic thread that ran through necessarily any one episode. A lot of times that I could just sort of grasp onto and feel like everything came back to that, which is one of the consequences I understand of having an ensemble show. But at the same time, I don't think any one season has felt quite as scattershot as this one. You mentioned a lot of parts that were really, really hard to watch just because of how literally abusive they were, not in terms of how this, you know, in any kind of comically exaggerated way of saying they were bad, but just literally saying that we were watching a lot of characters that we've invested in throughout the season, or throughout the past seasons, just pull complete 180s and become devoid of conscience and act absolutely deplorably, even considering the things that these obviously poorly trained COs had put them through. It wouldn't surprise me if a lot of people, when they watched the scene in the chapel, probably felt a lot like Alex did, just in terms of just kind of wanting to walk away from it and go, I don't want any part of this. This at this point, it isn't entertaining. It isn't making a point. This isn't character development. This isn't, you know, feeling satisfied with the way anybody is getting treated. And this is just flat out uncomfortable. And the talent show was at least moderately funny. I can at least come back to that part. But it feels like the show is starting to lose any kind of focus in terms of what it wants to be. And it feels like it's separating a lot of the characters rather than creating new interactions between them. And they're decisions that sort of perplex me a little. You've obviously got Doggett and Boo, and they've got their own dynamic. But it felt like for much of the first half, they were, again, just sort of their own faction unto themselves, and not really having much widespread interaction with anybody else. There were the moments between Maritza and Flocka with the jealousy over who was getting more YouTube attention, which became a matter of what is this actually accomplishing, aside from it being a semi-funny little micro-arc that's spanning a few episodes. It's too much that doesn't feel like it has any unity, and at the same time, on top of all that, you're watching characters sometimes that we've really come to kind of like really be treated pretty horribly. Caputo isn't perfect. He's come a long way since the first season. But it hurts a little bit to a certain extent to see him being lumped in with some of the other COs who really were just flat out unapologetically abusive.
I have to say, some of my favorite scenes of the season are between Caputo and Figueroa. And the line of the season comes from Jason's like, I don't know what kind of nasty pillow talk is going on here, but can we get back to business?
I've always loved the interaction between those two. And at the same time, it's also a period of adjustment because we're seeing characters that we've really enjoyed seeing the past few seasons just kind of suddenly disappear. Bursette comes to mind first and foremost. She's been a regular throughout just about the entire series. And, of course, obviously, it should almost be a running gag this time. If someone gets sent a shoe, you had better just say goodbye to them for the foreseeable future, because they ain't coming back.
Yeah.
Here,
not a whole lot of time spent in Max on this show.
Yeah. And here, I mean, that's kind of exactly what happens. You know, she goes off and kind of gets herself sent to SHU so she can find out what happened to Sister Ingalls, and then she gets her answer, and, oh, that's the last we see of her for the entire season, which is sad considering that if you want to look at TV from a social perspective, she's really been not just that Bursett has been one of the most important characters on TV in recent years to come along, especially in terms of representation for the trans community in a fictional setting, but also the fact that Laverne Cox has been a groundbreaking actress. In that, I believe, if memory serves, when she was cast, she was the first actual trans woman to be portraying a trans woman on a major drama. That was a huge deal. But and aside from that, her performances have also been excellent. Her arc has been extremely compelling, especially last season when we got to see the element of how not really having both parents around or having a father figure has really affected her son, and how he's gone from just being angry to being flat out kind of disturbing. And this season, all of a sudden, just a few episodes in, she's gone. Just bye-bye. I would also throw Ingalls in there in terms of somebody who was really getting to be pretty interesting in terms of her capacity to really break out and crusade for the betterment of Litchfield and to have a willingness to sacrifice of herself to do it. I'm trying to think of what I really want to say here. It's hard to invest sometimes when every time you get interested in something, all of a sudden you're slingshotted over to, meanwhile, back in the Hall of Justice. I think I have a good way to put it. And, of course, it wouldn't be a Rod Lichten Broadcast Network show if we didn't make a professional wrestling comparison.
Everyone take
a drink. Our audience, what'd you say?
Everyone take a drink.
Yeah. Ah, good coffee. It's my little David Otunga moment. I look at it at this point as being a lot like both what was good and bad about the Attitude Era in the WWF when Vince Russo and Ed Ferraro were booking. And that was the fact that one of the things where I've always kind of forgiven Russo for his foibles was the fact that, God love him, he tried to give everybody on a massive roster something to do, some kind of opportunity to get noticed on TV with an actual storyline. But as I've come to realize, as I've gone back and watched a lot of that without the rose-colored glasses on and without the nostalgia blinders, is I realize, yeah, but not everything you were giving people to do was actually good. Sometimes you were giving somebody something to do, and we were also all just left to ultimately go, okay, what was the point of that? What did I just watch? What did that actually contribute? And for as much as I love the ambition of the setting and I was intrigued by watching the whole ecosystem of Litchfield change, and how markedly different it was from past seasons, and seeing what happens when the status quo breaks down and you've got this power vacuum. At the same time, it was almost too wild. It was too crazy.
There are two things I want to address before we run out of time. We've got about 25 minutes left, but I want to make sure that we cover one particular part of the season and then maybe speculate on how they're going to deal with season six from where we leave off in season five. Let's talk about when the show drifted from comedy to dramedy, dramedy to comedy, to horror. Okay, let's talk about Piscatella as he performs his one man Friday the 13th review. So
Oh my God.
the setup to this is that they in their amphetamine driven nonsense, Blanca and Red, who I thought was a funny pairing this season,
It was, yeah.
discover that Piscatella done murdered an inmate in his previous position. This is how he got shipped over to Litchfield. They seek to expose him, and Red's big plan in her insanity is to lure him into the prison and then kidnap him, take him hostage, and make him signs or make him confess out loud to what he did. He does, in fact, get into the prison, but they are thwarted, undone. The whole thing's a mess, and he is ready to rumble. Now, initially, you're led to believe that he is in there to help, take back the prison. Nope, he becomes a horror monster for some odd reason, and one by one collects Red and her assemblage of allies and, and daughters, prison daughters as they are, for the purpose of abusing Red in front of these people, and he goes on to explain what his mustache twirly villainy is all about. They eventually overtake him, and he is in fact taken hostage. One of the str I'm going to go ahead and say this, and then we'll double back to your thoughts on the whole arc over a few episodes of this thing. But I thought one of the strongest elements of the entire season was summed up in Red letting him go. I talked a little bit about humanity, one sense of humanity in the midst of chaos. And even with Tasty pointing a gun at him and Red wanting to get her revenge on him, the realization that none of this, and certainly he, is not worth the loss of one's own humanity. And they say as long as he doesn't touch anybody, he is free to go. He isn't worth it. And I thought that was one of the more poignant, one of the strongest, one of the sharpest moments of the season. And then, of course, he gets shot by the CERT team, which in its own dark way was kind of funny. Sean, the Piscatella is Jason arc. Go. We have momentarily lost Sean, possibly to Piscatella. I'm sure he'll dial back in, presumably. Are you planning to call back? Are you planning to call back? Da-da-da-da-da. All right. While I'm waiting for him, let me quick just give my thoughts on it. Oh, never mind. Who cares what I think? Sean!
I have no idea what happened there. My thoughts on that, it's not like it was really a bad arc. It's just that it felt so damn out of place in the course of the entire season. I mean, we've had villains on this show. We've had detestable COs. We've had inmates we couldn't stand. But Piscatella is so over the top absurd that not just in behavior, but in terms of just the nature of his character and how out of place he feels. given the tenor of the way everything else is written and how grounded it tries to be, it really doesn't feel like it has any place whatsoever there. And then you have the rather anticlimactic element of, well, here's this important character that we've been building up over the past few seasons, and it's going to be a huge moment when they decide to, when, you know, Tasty and Red and everybody decides to embrace their inner humanity and let him go, but tells him, you know, sin no more, and then he ends up getting killed anyway. Then what the hell was the point of everything you just made us watch? It just became a matter of absolutely no consequence. It's like the way various things were, and I know I'm making some odd comparisons here, but stick with me. I'm using my frame of references of the shows I like. But unlike Breaking Bad, where for every action there was always an equal and opposite reaction, and there was always some fallout down the line, the bill always came due, it was more like what would happen sometimes on Friday Night Lights, where something seemingly major would happen, and it would be resolved in a quick, like, little 5-minute denouement, and then it would never be heard from again. Those of you who remember the Lila rapist arc from that show, you know exactly what I mean. It's just like, really, that's the way you're going to wrap that up. That's it. No indication this is going to have any further fallout. Unlike, like, say, Voss killing the guard who was, you know, who infiltrated the prison just to kill her, and that obviously has a ripple effect. It's just all impressions are, well, that's that. All that build up and that's it? That's seriously all? But it's something that I'm ultimately almost glad is probably just going to that's ultimately just going to be forgotten because it was a bad idea in the first place. But I feel like it was a waste of the Piscatella character in a way. I would have liked to have seen him maybe get worked in throughout subsequent seasons, but I guess they felt they had come to the end of the line and they just wanted to kind of do away with him in the most emphatic fashion. Or is this maybe like a behind-the-scenes scenario, like what happened on Lost occasionally, where somebody got killed off on the show and we found out later, oh, you got killed off because you were very, very naughty? Just, that's about my thoughts on it. was just as, you know, Damien Dark put it best on season 4 of Arrow. Well, that happened.
All right. Yeah, I agree largely with, I'm going to say this, and then we're going to transition to the last part of the show here. I largely agree with what you said as far as it felt very out of place. If there was a larger issue between Red and Piscatella, I didn't remember what it was, and I guess it happened in season 4. So to pick it up at the latter half of season 5 and give him this sort of single-minded mission to bring this woman down, in a way, while you've scared the living shit out of everyone around her, his mission there is to, like, I will bring you down in front of your daughters and tear the mask off you and show them who you really are. Okay, that only works if they're on a level where they can see that. At the moment, you have them tied up. Two of them are naked. they're not going to see anything but that you're a monster. Like, it was just poorly written, I thought. And I give credit to where credit is due. The show is mostly one of the more well-written shows on television, whether it be streaming or otherwise. But I just thought that whole setup was, unless the larger point they were trying to make is Piscatella is just an insane sociopath and a sadist, in which case I'm kind of with you with, and the point of all this was what again? But, you know, to set him up as such a monster and then for Red to ultimately let him go, even with his then subsequent, you know, shooting, making it all go, what the fuck did I just watch? I think a stronger thing would have been, and this is sort of a transition into what we're going to talk about next. You have the situation where they've gotten all the prisoners out of Litchfield and they're 10 short, which the math doesn't work on this, by the way, because two escaped. And even if you trade one for, you know, one of them for Linda, you know, you've got Chang who escaped. Okay. But you've got Linda to replace her. You still have Doggett who's escaped. And
I'm just gonna say I am so glad that Chang escaped.
Hooray for Chang. My point is the math on this doesn't work at all, and I'm wondering if they're ever gonna address it. In any case, the larger point here is there are 10 people who are missing. They must be in the pool. Well, if they're in the pool, then they're clearly staging some sort of violent uprising, which sets up the tension of where we leave our next cliffhanger. And I really did like the way, at least among the inmates, that this was handled. I love the fact that from beginning to end, the season is bookended with Frieda, who becomes a much stronger character this season instead of sort of Red's, you know, just sort of a sidekick character to Red. Frieda really steps out into her own, and I enjoy her character this season more so than the previous two seasons where they somewhat focused on her. In any case, they're like, okay, so you have the CERT team coming in, ready to murder everyone that looks cross-eyed at them, you know, and then you have these women sort of looking at each other going, what do we do now? And Frieda sort of takes a leadership role and says, we will go out with our dignity. Now, I think what I would have said was, we will get on our knees, put our hands behind our head, and we will say in unison, we are unarmed and we surrender. A stronger image in terms of entertaining television is certainly we will go out with our head held high with dignity, and we will stand here arm in arm and accept whatever recompense comes our way. Not the smartest way of handling it, but certainly the most dramatic. So I say unto you, Sean Comer, as we start to wrap this tale up, we are left with a hungry for hell CERT team ready to shoot and kill anyone that stands in their way. We have a chain link of women standing with their dignity, and we have two buses filled with Litchfield prisoners going every which way but loose. Predictions, sir. How do you see season six opening?
Yeah, to be honest, I kind of like the idea of each season sort of picking up moments after where the previous one left off. Obviously, you don't have a situation here where you have a scenario that's developed that can really take up several days over which you can spread out 13 episodes of television. So, I don't know. That's hard to say. Maybe we get a show where, for the time being, our arcs kind of get divided between Litchfield and how the prisoners who have been sent off someplace else are adjusting to their new environment, which I'm not sure how well that's going to play out, because that might very well kind of spread attention spans a little bit too thin in terms of giving them somehow even more to focus on than the dozen or so various arcs that are supposed to play into one big happening each season in Litchfield.
Let me ask you very directly. Think anyone dies? Think anyone gets shot by the CERT team?
I don't know. I have no idea, because that's one thing about this show is you have some characters who main characters, major characters, like Nikki and Voss and Bursette, who suddenly disappear for a long stretch of time unexpectedly. And then there's a way that they ultimately get worked back into the narrative. And then there's other times where in past seasons they've had characters that seemed like they were building them up, like, okay, this is somebody that we want the audience to invest in, somebody that we would like to have around for a while. And then just, nope. they're gone too. Ruby Rose's character was a bit of a shit stirrer and seemed like this was somebody that was going to be around for a bit. Nope, she basically became more cannon fodder for Piper shenanigans. You had Lolly, who was absolutely wonderful from her first time on the show until the last time we saw her. She's gone. Even if you go clear back to the very first season. My shit memory for names here. The one Caribbean lady, the former housekeeper who Shank
and I know the character you're talking about. Yeah, she was Piper's original roommate.
Yeah, you know who I mean. Who seemed to be downright sympathetic. She completely lost it when she found out that the man she loved had gotten married and would not be having the life with her that she wanted, and she just snaps and gets herself sent to Max and seemingly doesn't think anything of it. So it's hard to say. We might have somebody we've been seeing season after season who just all of a sudden out of the blue is mostly absent from next year, or it may be that somehow everybody avoids consequences. What I do think is going to happen is I think that this confrontation with 13 is going to kind of bring a lot of things that have been going on with everybody to a reckoning. In particular, it wouldn't surprise me if we saw Alex somehow finally be confronted with the murder that's on her hands. I don't know what might happen to everybody else. Maybe Piper manages to get some time tacked onto her sentence, and that pads the show out to run for as long as it needs to. But it's hard to say what I think is going to happen, but I do hope they manage to keep everything centered again on Litchfield, because it felt this season like the show was starting to get a little bit desperate in terms of ways to come up with enough material to write 13 episodes around. And
I'm
going to
give one prediction.
Go ahead and throw out your prediction. Go ahead.
I have one prediction. Someone will get shot and die in that gang of 10. And I predict it'll be Alex. And not just because, well, you know, Laura Prepon really? Has got to have some other things to do. But they made a big point of Piper in her character arc of becoming selfless and knowing that it isn't just a thing that's important to her, but the people in her life are important to her, and most important is Alex, and she truly loves her, and she realizes she can't be without her. Now is the perfect time to kill her. Right? Because no one is allowed to be happy. That is a lesson I've learned from watching a lot of these shows. No one is allowed to be happy. No situation can ever be truly resolved. I don't know. What was it I was just watching where it was just like nothing ever works out for anybody? So I have a sneaking suspicion that, well, some of them may get injured with bullets. The one that's going to take one right to the noodle is going to die is going to be Alex. I'll also say I think we'll do two or three episodes where the women will be in scattered prisons, and there'll be a thing where, you know, justice for Litchfield, and you must bring these people back, and you must open the prison, and there's pressure on the governor and MCC, and everyone comes back to Litchfield, and we, you know, and we finish out Piper's sentence at Litchfield. Whether or not they're going to use this as an opportunity to tack on more time for her so that we have more Piper. I don't know. I think the showrunner should be brave and let's try a season without Piper. I think at this point we're all pretty seasoned in the ways of the prison industrial complex and Litchfield in particular. I don't know if Piper at this point is needed. I'm going to give you just a minute to respond to that, and then we're going to do plugs and get out of here.
Okay. About all that I really have left to say is that I'm going to be kind of bold and say that I think that either next season or maybe a season after should probably be the wrap up for the show.
Mm.
I think that should be it, because at this point you would have to rank Orange is the New Black alongside House of Cards as being Netflix's biggest breakout originals by far. They are the flagships, the ones they have most staked their name on. I'm trying to remember the Stephen Van Zandt series where he was a mafioso who was in WITSEC and was shipped off to, I think, some little Norwegian town or something. I'm blanking on the name. But I know that that was a big deal at the time, but by far the ones that garnered the biggest mainstream recognition and applause are House of Cards and, again, Orange is the New Black. And given that Orange in particular is closing in on six seasons next year, seven if it goes another one after that, and that seven is about where most shows nowadays, not called The Big Bang Theory, really start to show their age and run out of gas, I would really like to see Jenji Cohen know where to end the series and to bring some closure to the whole thing before it starts just becoming a cash cow that Netflix must milk every year. And I think that with their willingness to cancel a number of shows already this off season, I think they're showing that it'll probably be better for them to just go out willingly, already setting up the end game, rather than having Netflix unceremoniously pull the plug.
Well, it's got two more seasons left that it's already been renewed for, so we're definitely getting season 6 and 7. I agree with you. My last words on this, I agree with you. I think season 7 should be it. But let me reiterate, I think one more season with Piper. I think season 6 has to end with Piper going home, and we get a completely Piperless season 7. That's how I'd like to see the show go out. I want to see the show shift its focus from, look at the new white girl in the prison. Isn't this funny? To let's focus more on Tasty. Let's focus more on what's her face? The one who was trying to get home to her son who's in the hospital. Let's focus on her.
Gloria.
Hey, let's focus on Brissett. Gloria. Let's focus on Brissett.
Yeah.
Let's not focus on the meth heads too much. Yeesh. You know, let's get some other characters in there to focus on. Let's tell this tale. Let's, you know, and let's, and then let's let's give it a rest. You know, at this point, I think if the 7th season of Orange is the New Black, you either get it or you don't. And let's move on and tell a different story. And speaking of different stories, let's move on and talk about a different podcast. Next week, we've got, what do we got here? What's going on? Where am I?
I know we have On Trial. I'm just trying to remember which one we're doing.
Not next week. We took next week off. So as far as what are me and you doing, next week the shows are Source Material on Monday is The Poison Ivy, The Cycle of Life and Death. Damn You Hollywood is back. We'll be reviewing the Pixar Cars 3. And then, of course, Metal Hammer of Doom, Nickelback. I wouldn't give you a penny back. I've been looking forward to this show all summer. Nickelback.
Nickelback? What?
Yep.
Why in the world are you talking about Nickelback on Metal Hammer?
Because the shows where we tear apart albums are usually our best shows. And I can't imagine this show is going to go very far without ripping it to pieces.
Oh,
the
God
hilarity.
Bless you.
The week after is Transformers Week. We've got Revolution on Source Material, a review of The Last Night on Damn You Hollywood. The Metal Hammer of Doom will be reviewing the Transformers cartoon soundtrack. And Ronnie Adams and I will be doing a TV party tonight for Transformers Prime Season 1. Now the following week, Sean and I will reunite here. We'll just get right to this. July 6th is the next time Sean and I will be getting together, but not for an On Trial. It'll be for a TV party tonight. Speaking of Genji Cohen, we'll be looking at GLOW, Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, the latest Netflix show. So I can't wait for that. Sean and I are certainly going to have a grand old time talking about that. However, the following week, and this will be our last set of plugs here. Two more sets of plugs. The following week is Spider-Man week. We've got a Spider-Man show. Don't know what we're doing quite yet, but we're doing a Spider-Man show on Source Material, a review of Spider-Man Homecoming. Metal Hammer of Doom is going to review Power Flow, featuring members of Sendog, Biohazard, and other bands. And then On Trial, The Amazing Spider-Man 2. Sean and I are going to debate it. And then the following week, we have another On Trial. We've got Source Material, Tarzan on the Planet of the Apes, War for the Planet of the Apes, review on Damn You Hollywood, the new Dying Fetus, Wrong Ones to Fuck With, and as I said, Sean and I will be doing an On Trial for Planet of the Apes, the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, it's going to be terrific. So look for that.
I have to somehow defend this damn thing.
Yep.
I have to come up with something redeeming other than well, Mark Wahlberg aside, it's got an awesome cast.
All right, Sean, go ahead and do your plugs, and then we're gonna call it a night.
Time being, I'd really like to do more podcasting and writing of the entertaining variety in the near future, but for now, I've sort of got some other things that are taking priority, and so everything that Mark mentioned is where you can find me. I'll let you guys know when I'm going to be a little more active on the socials again. But as it's always my thing to say, thank you to each and every last one of you who downloads the show, who listens live, those of you who love it and tell a friend, those of you who hate it and tell someone you hate. We always appreciate it, because we live to entertain and inform about the nerdy things that we love, the things that we obsess about to make adulting bearable. So by all means, thank you all for that. Keep listening, keep posting to our socials with your feedback. We always look forward to hearing from it. If you have ideas for future episodes of TV Party Tonight, Because Blank Made Me, Metal Hammer of Doom, On Trial, anything like that, by all means, bring them on. We love to hear them, and you never know when one of them might actually turn into a show. So thank you very much, everybody.
remember that $10 will still buy mini peanuts. Never dull your colors for someone else's canvas.
All right, inmates, lights out. Be well, be safe, and behave.
The animal, trap, 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 till the cages fall. The cages fall, today is new, and everyone is waiting, waiting on you, and you gotta die. Think of all the roads, think of all the crossing. Taking steps is easy, standing still is hard. Remember all their faces, remember all their voices. Everything is different the second time around.